Good morning. Our first case today is case 06-1366, the State of Ohio versus Dwayne Short. Mr. Krim?
Yes. I would like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to focus on the first, second, and fourth propositions of law in my argument this morning. I'm here on behalf of Dwayne Short. Mr. Short was found guilty of the double homicides of Rhonda Short and Don Sweeney. The homicides occurred in 2004. He proceeded with court-appointed Rule 20 certified counsel until May of 2005, when they had worked out a deal which would have resulted in his receiving a life sentence. The family became upset. They retained a private attorney to represent Mr. Short. Mr. Short accepted that representation because there was a time between the initial decision and the acceptance of the plea before a three-judge panel. The plea did not go forward. New counsel took over. They had a series of motion hearings. They had mental health evaluations for competency at the time of the offense, as well as, and the result was by late March of 2006, they were looking at a trial beginning in late April. At a hearing in the end of March, his counsel announced to the court three things. They announced that they were not going to have any psychological testimony at mitigation. They were not going to retain a mitigation investigator, and that they would talk to the lawyer, that the lawyer would go talk to the family sometime next week. It is our contention that this was basically an announcement contra, if anything, Rompila and Wiggins, that says that while lawyers have to make decisions, they have to make the decisions after they've investigated the matter. What happened here was they announced they were not going to have any psychological testimony before they'd found out whether they would need any psychological testimony.
Had there been psychologicals done before that?
The only psychologicals had been done were not for mitigation purposes. They were mental health evaluations that relied heavily on self-reporting and some testing that was done. The psychologicals were part of the exhibits, and they show much of the information that they relied upon to determine that he was competent to stand trial was based on what he was reporting to them. A number of things he reported in them are things that would be that many of us would see as things that would require investigation, such as a head injury a few years before and things like that. There's no evidence that these were ever checked into.
I'm trying to pick up on your argument, Mr. Krim. You indicate to us that at the outset, with appointed counsel, there was an arrangement for a life sentence for
Yes.
Mr. Short. And after counsel was retained, the matter went to trial.
Yes.
And now a jury has recommended and the court has imposed a death sentence for
Yes.
Mr. Short. And you don't have an allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel in the propositions. Am I correct about that?
I believe proposition of law number four deals with inadequacy of counsel.
It's inadequacy, and you're suggesting that's ineffective counsel for
Yes.
that? Is that what your position is?
Yes.
And is that your, you said you were focused on the first, second, and fourth, was that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what is the basis of that argument with ineffective assistance of counsel? How do you premise that argument?
Inadequacy of counsel is addressed on post-conviction, because while you may have actions of a lawyer's that are apparent, you don't have facts that would support prejudice. Here, there is in the record For example, the testimony, not the testimony, excuse me, the letter by his sister that we quoted in our brief that puts out, again, information that would have been mitigating had it been presented to the jurors. And it was never presented to the jurors.
Did your client indicate he did not want that to be presented?
That was the recommendation of his counsel, and that's what he acquiesced to. There was a hearing. There was an attempt to have an Ashworth hearing, and I get confused because Ashworth is when, and I've had a couple of cases before this court where my clients have done that and have been executed. But what they're doing is they're waiving all the mitigation, they're pleading guilty and wanting to proceed. Here, at the end of the liability phase, the next Monday morning, all of a sudden he's waiving any further mitigation evidence. Then his lawyers are going forth and trying to argue mitigation from what's on the record. At the trial, the lawyers were basically told, they were not permitted to examine one of the witnesses, a police officer from Middletown or Hamilton, who basically didn't arrest him, but took him to the hospital because of suicide issues. They attempted to inquire into that during the liability phase, and basically, I believe the prosecutors conceded that it would be appropriate to have this person testify during mitigation, but they did not proceed to call him at all. So this information was not presented to the jurors.
And the thrust of your argument goes to the lack of mitigation. Nothing with respect to the guilt.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Clearly, actions were premeditated in the purchase of the sawed-off shotgun, sawing off the barrel of the shotgun, in going to the home bringing the ammunition. It was all, there's no question about that.
No, I'm not contesting.
Gunshot to the gentleman in the backyard and one gunshot to his ex wife.
Well, they weren't divorced, they were trying to get separated, or she was trying to get separated. The only thing I would say about it is I think that there's material that could have been developed during the trial that might have been helpful, but I don't believe it meets the prejudice standard. I don't think it would change the result, and we're not contesting the liability issues.
Well, counsel, if you were to prevail, what would the solution be? An additional mitigation phase?
Yes, I believe that if we were to prevail, that there would have to be a new mitigation hearing, and I believe under the current statutes that a new jury could be drawn and a mitigation hearing could be held.
And you would, at that point envision a psychological examination to be presented to the jury?
I would anticipate having more mitigation.
What would you?
I would anticipate at least having the sister testify and the police officer, I believe it's from Middletown, testify. I suspect there's been a post-conviction proceeding filed, and I would imagine that there's more information that is not currently before the court that would be brought up at that hearing, or that would be brought up in a mitigation hearing, but that's not currently in the record.
At the trial, was his employer put on the stand to?
Yes, his employer was put on the stand.
So he recounted, presumably, that your client had these feelings that he was going to commit suicide, I assume.
I believe so, yes.
So the jury that's deciding the punishment is aware that he was enormously distraught to the point of suggesting to his employer that he might commit suicide.
Yes, I believe that was in the record. It was not argued by his lawyers at the mitigation hearing, however. They basically argued only that he shouldn't be judged on what he did in a few hours. I believe that the issues should have been laid out more clearly for the jurors, what was mitigation, what they should be doing.
Counsel, you indicated that it was not Mr. Short's decision, or maybe it was his decision, but it was based upon recommendation of counsel.
Yes.
That's your position, that he only did this because of counsel rather than the other way around, that he was directing counsel that he didn't want to do it?
There's some colloquy after the mitigation hearing at the actual sentencing, in which at the time of the hearing, at the time of this waiver, for lack of a better word, he started to ask some questions. Then he talked to his lawyers and he didn't say anything. He then attempted to explain at the sentencing hearing that he did have concerns about it and that he did want to bring this out. However, the lawyers had, he was doing what his lawyers told him to do.
I want to back up to the decision to bring in employed counsel and to remove the appointed counsel. You said the family got involved. Was he not the decision maker here?
He didn't have the resources to do it. I believe his father actually retained the lawyer.
Okay. And at the time they did that, on the table was the opportunity to plead, get life, and not have the death penalty.
I believe that was, I don't know if it was precisely on the table at the time of the change of counsel. I believe that was the status.
And what would retained counsel, what could they reasonably believe they could achieve that wasn't already being achieved by the public defender?
I don't know, Your Honor.
The way it unfolded, it doesn't appear there's anything that they thought they could do to improve his chances.
Yeah, I don't think the record shows any what they could have done.
Was the life sentence, the plea bargain, rejected by the new attorney or by the first attorney, and then that first attorney was dismissed and the new attorney was selected?
I believe it was rejected by the new attorney. I don't think it was rejected by the Rule 20 counsel, no.
Okay, and it was still then on the table?
I believe so.
Well, was it or not?
The record isn't to, I believe it was, and I'm not sure the record is very clear on that. At this point, I don't recall that part of the record very clearly.
Okay, but we know that it was your client that rejected the offer. It was not the prosecutor withdrawing the offer.
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
Do you agree that the test to be followed here on ineffective assistance is the test promulgated in Strickland versus Washington?
Yes.
And what is the evidence to show that the outcome would have been different that we could find in the record?
I believe that the testimony of the police officer from Middletown that wasn't brought out on mitigation, and I believe that the letter from the sister laying out all the information, those are the two pieces of evidence currently in the record.
We really don't know if that would have changed the outcome or not, do we? It's speculation, really, at best.
Well, I think that it is, any analysis under these situations is to some extent speculative, but the Supreme Court has said that that's the kind of analysis that has to be done in these cases. And I will concede that usually this information is not in the record on a direct appeal. There's more information here than what usually comes out in a direct appeal.
Is there evidence in the record that your client indicated to the first set of attorneys that he wanted to waive all mitigation? That was his view from the outset?
No, this was not done that way. There may have been some discussion at some point, but he was not, that was not the way they were proceeding. And they had worked out a deal.
But as you said in answer to the chief's question, he repudiated that deal, didn't he?
Yes, with new counsel, they repudiated the deal. It was not the fact that the government withdrew it.
It is, I suppose there's no way to tell. Here's a man who planned, went to some effort to plan the execution of two people. His announced plan included taking his own life. Then he didn't. So one way to look at this is, after he had some time to think about it, he was upset with himself for not having the courage to take his own life and wanted to achieve that through the process that we're all caught up in now. Is that a fair or unfair way to look at this?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I don't think so because he did, there was, while the Ashworth went on, that was not a complete waiver of mitigation. And in fact, he was at the time of, within minutes after the Ashworth, his lawyers were arguing that he shouldn't be executed. At the sentencing, he put forth more reasons himself in allocution why he shouldn't be executed. It was not, this was not a case where, as with both Mr. Mink and Mr. Ferguson, where they basically from the time they woke up out of their drug stupors, they were working at seeing that nothing mitigating happened. And, you know, there was consistency in those cases that simply is not present here. And there was a lot of time given to contemplate that. On the issue of additional evidence, I did want to make one comment, and that is that this court has said that the trial judge is to use the same evidence that the jurors hold and have. But in this case, the trial judge actually used other evidence. The jurors did not have access to the psychological information. Those were introduced as court exhibits but were never presented to the jurors. And they were not argued either by the government or by the defense. They were exhibits in the same hearing, but the record is clear that they were never presented to the jurors.
So the fact that the judge looked at those in determining the sentence, even though the jury didn't look at it in determining the guilt phase, is a flaw, you say?
That's not the flaw. It's an example of where the judge has used additional evidence. The lawyers...
Additional to what? I mean, if they were in evidence, can you dictate to the judge what pieces of evidence the judge relies on?
They were not in evidence. They were in evidence for the determination of competency at the Ashworth hearing. They were not in evidence before the jurors for mitigation. And one of the things we're asking the court to reconsider is its decision that the judges cannot, that you can't put more evidence into the record before a judge after the jurors have heard the mitigation evidence. And I'm suggesting that judges do get access and do use additional information so that the tests in that case aren't, that really we're not following that case.
So Mr. Krim, I understand that the idea of waiving the mitigation in front of the jury relates to your claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. And one of the things that we need to determine is the actual standard to see if the attorneys fell below the standard. So I'm trying to find out what you are saying the standard should be with respect to waiver of mitigation. Can you help me on that, please?
I believe that before a lawyer can recommend something, a course of action, a strategy, if you will, on mitigation, the lawyer has an obligation to investigate. Regardless of whether his client wants him to investigate or not, he has an obligation to investigate.
Do we have evidence that the attorneys did not investigate?
I believe that their comments on the record at the March 31st hearing to the effect that they were not going to call a psychologist, they were not going to have a mitigation investigator, and that they would go talk to the family next week is that evidence.
Didn't they also at that hearing, though, state that they had talked to their client, they had investigated, and there was no need for the mitigation expert? Wasn't that part of what was said on the record?
That may be. The record says what it says.
I mean, because we were to make a determination on this issue, it affects capital cases for the future, and it affects defense counsel who need to understand what they are required to do. So that's what I want to explore with you.
I think the issue is, and here it's where we are with post-conviction and versus a direct appeal. There isn't as much information on the record. I think under this court's decision in Johnson that was cited in the briefs, that the judge probably should have made a little more careful inquiry. It might have been an on-the-record ex parte inquiry as to what had happened. But here, the judge made no inquiry. And, of course, it was not suggested by the defense lawyers.
Wouldn't you say the judge should have made inquiry? The judge asked whether this was the defendant's wish. He didn't go so far as to say, why do you feel that way? But he did ascertain to his satisfaction that what the defendant's understanding was of a waiver of mitigation.
Right. But what I think should have happened is the lawyers had an obligation to investigate further.
Well, the lawyer's representation was, quote, we made a thorough investigation of mitigating evidence, including of family members and other persons. And if they're making that representation to the court, and the court inquires of the defendant as to his voluntariness and his understanding of waiving of the mitigation, I'm not sure what more could have been done.
I think what the judge should have done was to have an ex parte hearing to get more specific what witnesses they talked to.
Because pardon me?
I think there should have been an ex parte hearing in this case where the judge inquired of the counsel what witnesses they talked to, because they obviously had not thought through the issue.
When should a judge start to invade the purview of strategy and representation?
Fine line. The Johnson case, though, does say that the court has some obligation to look into those matters. And I think here where the counsel, they may have talked, they've talked about very abstractly what they did, and then their actions later on did not reflect, if they'd talked, for example, to the police officer, why would they try to bring out his testimony at the hearing to the point that they were told, you know, you can't do it here, but you can do it in mitigation?
Well, maybe they determined that that wasn't really something that was going to be valuable in mitigation, which is their strategy.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm saying is that it's not very clear that they had a well-thought-out strategy, I don't believe.
Mr. Krim, what is your view about a defendant's right to control his own defense?
The defendant has a right to decide ultimately what happens, but it has to be based on the lawyers giving advice. Before the lawyers can give advice, the Supreme Court cases, U.S. Supreme Court cases, are very clear. They have to have conducted a thorough investigation. And I think that the evidence in the record here is that it's not the kind of thorough investigation I've seen in other cases.
Your view is that the defendant's right is paramount?
The defendant has a right to make the ultimate decision, but that decision must be based on advice from counsel.
If that decision is expressed somewhere in the record in response to judicial questioning, is that sufficient to close inquiry on it?
If it's based on adequate investigation and advice of counsel, then it would be, as it was in the Mink and Ferguson cases.
Okay.
You're into your rebuttal time,
fine,
counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Ingram?
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. On behalf of the state of Ohio, I am asking this court to reject Dwayne Short's claims of error to find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt, to find that the penalty is proportionate, and to impose the sentence of death that the jury recommended and the trial court adopted. As I address the first two parts of Short's argument, these facts are critical to remember. Dwayne Short made an informed, voluntary, and rational decision in consultation with counsel not to introduce additional mitigating evidence. Why? He explained in allocution. He did say, because I concluded that whatever little mitigation I had just wasn't sufficient when compared to the fact that I had killed two people. Another factor that's critical to remember is that this decision represented a sound strategy, because what it allowed him to do was to take information that was admitted in the first portion of the trial and to take that information and weave it into a narrative, a plausible narrative, that presented Short as a hardworking, decent man who snapped when his wife left him. Had he put on mitigation evidence, had he introduced additional witnesses to testify in his behalf, that narrative would have been complicated because those witnesses would have been subject to cross-examination. And the same kind of information that Mr. Krim pointed you to in the competency evaluations, there's additional information that would undermine the picture that they were able to paint simply relying on evidence that was already admitted. Another point to remember is that there's no proffer here of the evidence, the kind of evidence we're talking about, what he could have admitted. And I submit that the statement of his sister, Tracy Watson, isn't an accurate snapshot. It's a statement. It's not. It contains inadmissible evidence. It contains opinions. It contains scripture. And it's never been subject to cross-examination.
If we were to affirm this case based on the status of the record, the defendant would have an additional opportunity to come back then on post-conviction and try to present perhaps evidence outside the record that the defense attorney keeps alluding to may exist to establish perhaps there are other factors that aren't in the record?
That's correct. And that there is a post-conviction relief pending, and that is one of the assignments of error, or one of the claims in the post-conviction. When he stood before the court, though, on May 8th, just at the beginning of the mitigation phase of the trial and told the court that he did not wish to introduce additional mitigating evidence, he was doing what he had done since the beginning of the proceedings, which is exploring his options, exercising those options, consulting with counsel, and making a rational choice, rational voluntary choice, that, as he later said, he did because of certain reasons. When he said that, to the extent that the trial court had a duty, it was a duty to determine that he was competent. Now, the evidence doesn't suggest, there's nothing in the record to suggest that that choice not to introduce additional mitigating evidence was because of counsel's advice. But even if it were, that is a decision, unlike the decision to waive all mitigation and plead guilty, the decision to forego additional, as he cites on page 14 of his brief, is not a fundamental right. It's a tactical decision counsel is empowered to make. But
is there any evidence in the record that sheds light on why he terminated or the court-appointed counsel and sought retained counsel, who then rejected the life offer?
There is no evidence as to why that happened. The evidence does show that after what had happened was he had agreed to this plea offer, and that he had actually been in court, and the trial judge had gone through a lengthy plea colloquy to make sure that he understand exactly what he was doing, and that the next step was to seat a three-judge panel. But before that date, his father retained counsel, and the court did ask him on the record, is this how you wish to proceed? You know, do you wish to, you know, withdraw and proceed and go ahead with your suppression hearing? And he said yes. So there's no explanation of why, just that his father had hired counsel.
There's been a suggestion made that this is part of his death wish. He didn't commit suicide successfully, and then by waiving the life agreement and going to a trial with a good probability of a death penalty based on these facts. Is that part of the scenario, do you believe?
No, and I can tell you why. First of all, when he spoke in allocution, he explained why he didn't want to put on additional mitigating evidence. He said, I thought whatever little I might have in mitigation didn't offset the fact that I killed two people, and I want it to be over. What's more, because of the posture of this case, because of all the things that happened prior to trial, there are four psych reports on this person, two of which I am positive are in the record before this court. Those are the competency evaluations. One of those competency evaluations was specifically directed toward the Ashforth inquiry because at one point he said, I want to plead guilty and forego all mitigation. So the court ordered the inquiry to be done. And it came back and he expressed that it was his belief that it was better that living in prison the rest of his life was not acceptable to him. So those reports do give an explanation that doesn't suggest at all that this was part of a death wish that he's asking the state to carry out. I think that it forecloses that.
What did you just say about living in prison was not acceptable to him?
Yeah, it was the idea that we often hear that foregoing mitigation, which would practically, you know, which would really increase the chances that he would receive a death penalty, meant that if he were to receive a sentence other than death, he would spend the rest of his life in prison, and he didn't want to do that.
Well, that was the first offer that was on the table to begin with.
Correct.
So you're saying that he rejected the first offer because he wanted to have the death penalty?
I don't know what he was thinking. I know that the first thing within a few months of his indictment, he came into court and announced that he wanted to plead guilty and forego all mitigation. The court ordered this evaluations. And then before that happened, he agreed to plead guilty, at which point before the three-judge panel he then withdrew that and counsel was retained. He has given a number of reasons that can be found in the record over time to explain his decision, none of which suggests that he has a death wish.
Counsel, I don't recall seeing the argument that we have here that we should revisit the Roe case and permit, if requested, the offering of additional mitigation evidence to the judge, who does, under the statute, have an independent duty to weigh and determine whether or not death should be imposed. That's an 89 case, so it predates even me.
I'm sorry, it predates what?
It predates even me here at the court. I don't recall it seeing this set up in any other case. Has that decision of this court been subjected to scrutiny in the federal courts in any case following back when Roe came out?
Your Honor, I can't answer that. I can certainly research it after I leave today and submit something if you'd like. But as I stand here today, I don't know the answer to that. But speaking to that procedure that he has come up with, there's kind of like two bases for this. One is a statutory basis, which is, you know, 2919, the general felony statute, gives the person the opportunity to present additional information before the sentencing judge. But this is a more specific, and we know that 2929, I think it's 03, takes sentencing for aggravated murder out of the ordinary sentencing statute.
And it says you have to give everything to the jury that you have.
Well, right? Well, it doesn't. The procedure for independent weighing by the trial court doesn't permit any, there's no mechanism for the court to review information that wasn't submitted for the jury. And as the court said in Roe, there's no justification for allowing a person to put on a partial mitigation hearing in front of the jury and then saving some back in case they really needed it to present to the judge alone.
No, it's argued here that the judge, in fact, considered something more than the jury was able to consider. Is that argument because it was definitely in play, or is it because we know the judge had to read that stuff earlier on, so the judge can't put it out of his mind?
Well, I mean, what stuff specifically are you referring to?
The psychological exams that were not presented to the jury.
Well, the judge said, I combed the record and I looked at this, and here's why, and here's why. She was looking for mitigation evidence. So, yes, yeah, she did look at that. But that was actually in the record. This is information that they're just going to bring in.
Right, I understand. But so you concede that the trial judge acknowledged that she considered matters that the jury did not have available to consider in the mitigation phase.
But which were in the record? Which were in the record? I would say this also. In addition to the decision in Roe.
But doesn't that undercut then the argument against allowing additional mitigation to be presented to the trial judge?
In this case, I would suggest that we look at the statute to see, because I'm saying this was in the record. This was something that the statute empowered the court to look at. This additional information that he wants to bring on just before sentencing, that's something he's basing on A, 29-29-19, which doesn't support it, and B, due process. And as to due process, in his brief, he argues at length that because he has a right to mitigation, he ought to have been able to put this in. But we know that Ohio's scheme does what it's supposed to do, that is, ensures individualized sentencing by the framework for introducing mitigation, and that simply because he has that he believes that his information or his evidence could come in a way that was more helpful to him, doesn't mean that he has a right to present it in that way. If the framework is sufficient to allow individualized sentencing, the fact that he's got a better idea isn't sufficient under due process. And also, if it were true that his right to present mitigation under the due process is so broad, then since this court too must conduct an independent evaluation of the aggravating circumstances and mitigating factors in imposing sentence, then if it were true that it's that broad, then he too would have the right to come before this court if he had some additional mitigating evidence. There's no reason that his argument would cut off at the trial court.
That's a pretty powerful argument against the argument that's been advanced, because it would seem that would be right, that if it's fair, the statute clearly says get it all in front of the jury. And if due process allowed a second bite at the apple, then it should allow it here as mm-hmm. well.
Correct, right. Which is why I think that argument
yeah.
fails. I want to talk to just a little bit about the idea that the court was required to do more when he said he wished to waive additional mitigation. To the extent the court had a duty at all, it was to determine whether he was competent, and he unquestionably was. There was two competency evaluations before the court. Once the court had determined that, then there was no duty for the court to inquire to make sure his reasons were really good. And let me say this. There is no question, when you review the entire record of this case, that this was a man that was in control of his defense from the outset. His initial view, and initially he rejected the advice of counsel, and said he wanted to waive mitigation and plead guilty. The record shows that he had no difficulty in making his own decision and in making it on consideration of all the factors. And because of the history of this case with his initial desire to plead guilty and waive all mitigation and his later acceptance of this plea offer, he was given a huge amount of education or the court went out of its way to make sure, because of these processes, that he knew what he was doing and how this process operated. And
Ms. Ingram, did Mr. Short reject the plea bargain, or was that done through counsel?
The record does not show that it was his idea. The record does show that when he came in with new counsel and when the court was discharging his prior counsel, that was his wish. So we don't know where the idea generated, but it was clear from the record that it was his wish at that point to proceed with new counsel and to proceed to trial.
Okay.
And what, you know, I'm a little bit troubled by is that his first posture was, I want to plead guilty, I want to waive mitigation. And in exchange for that, there was life imprisonment on the table. Then his next posture is, I want to reject that, and I don't want to plead guilty, I want to take this to trial. Mm-hmm. And then during the trial proceedings, I want to waive mitigation. And they're inconsistent in his, if he's in charge of his case and the proceedings, it just, the initial posture doesn't mesh with going to trial, and then at the end of trial, okay, I want to waive all mitigation again. The continuity there escapes me.
He had no good choices, Your Honor. He had no good choices.
Well, out of this scenario, I don't think anybody would argue against the first choice of being the best choice.
The first choice was his. The first choice was, I flat out want to plead guilty, forego all mitigation, and take my chances. That was the first. There was no, initially, the record shows there was no plea offer. It was, I want to do this. Counsel doesn't want me to do this. I want to do it. At that point, the court ordered the ash for inquiry. Before that happened, though, was the plea bargain, and he came in and was willing to plead. So what he's doing, he doesn't have good choices, but he's exploring all of them. And what we know every step of the way was that he's a competent adult, and he could make those choices. The court honored his choices and honored his when he changed his mind as far as it could. But at the very end, he had run out of options. But he was directing his defense, and he was assisted by two very skilled, very experienced attorneys. And the eventual decision not to put on additional information in mitigation, but to weave a mitigation case out of the evidence that was already in the record, prevented mitigation witnesses that he might have called from being their testimony compromised or contradicted. I'm sorry.
And had he pursued a mitigation phase after the finding of guilt by the jury, by the jury, what was his best option? What the best outcome would have been at the end of a mitigation phase for him?
At the end of the mitigation, had he pursued it?
Had he pursued mitigation, and what would be the potential best outcome of a mitigation?
A life sentence.
A life sentence, right.
Right.
That he had at the very beginning.
And which at the very, you know, let me jump ahead to his allocution. He, at that point, even in his allocution, he himself wasn't, he says on the transcript before he begins with his allocution, this is a statement I wanted to give to the jury. His only regret was not making this statement he gave to the judge as an unsworn statement to the jury. But if you look at that statement, there's no mitigation in there at all. It is a matter of settling scores. Mm-hmm. He doesn't ask for mercy. He doesn't say he blames everyone else. He doesn't ask for any consideration or any mitigation of his sentence. He's settling a score. So to the extent that we're talking about a man who changed his mind after the jury came back? I don't know that that's true, because his allocution suggests that he didn't. He never asks for a life sentence. He never asks for mercy. He never asks for consideration. He blames his wife. He blames the man he killed. He blames the mother of the man he killed. He quotes scripture. He complains about the media. He says he could have been a better husband. Well, yeah. He was controlling this defense. A competent adult controlling the defense no less than he attempted to control his wife, to control his family, and no less than he controlled his actions when he, on July 22nd, when he lied to find out where she was living, drove to her house, bought a gun, took his son, sawed the shotgun off with his son sitting on the barrel to hold it steady, drove back and shot Donnie Sweetie in the yard, burst into the house, his wife was in the shower, and shot her. He directed his activities that day in the same way that he directed in his defense. The judge told him at the outset, you're driving the bus here, and he did. He did.
Counsel, his boss, his employer, testified at the trial.
Yes.
And did his testimony include the indication that he was extremely distraught and contemplating suicide and all those things that he had told his boss?
His boss testified that he was very upset. I don't believe there was a direct reference to suicide, but there was a lot of evidence in the record about his state of mind.
From his boss and from others?
Well, from his son, Justin, who he took with him. Justin testified, my dad was real sad that night. He was really upset. And then Justin testified as to what they did that week. There's no lack of information that would tend to show that he was very upset when his wife left him. But the evidence in the record from the trial phase was unsullied. The state didn't cross-examine any of those people that he might have called, like the police officer or his sister or those people. And, you know, the same way that there's information, I can assure you that those witnesses, that testimony would not be as we imagine it. It would have been cross-examined, contradicted.
Was the testimony from his son, his employer, and others about his state of mind argued by his defense counsel in the mitigation phase, to the jury?
Counsel did an extremely good job of weaving that in. Counsel had a coherent two-part argument. One, this is a decent, hardworking man whose heart was broken when his wife left him. You and I may not have snapped this way, but, you know, he fought his devils for a week until he snapped and did this. And don't judge a man by what happened in 7 hours of his life. That's plausible in the sense of superficially reasonable based on the evidence that was in the case. Had he called mitigation witnesses, it wouldn't have been that smooth and clean and compelling. It would have been muddy because that's an incomplete picture. But he was able to proceed with this narrative that cast him in a more sympathetic light than he would have been had he put on witnesses that were subject to cross-examination. And I also want to say, too, that while he could have put on that evidence of how distraught he was, the evidence that he did put on that was already in the record shows that on the night she left, when he was so distraught, he was surrounded by his family, and they took him to the hospital. That night, she left, and she started going from motel to motel to hide from him. She was alone, without a job, without any money, with two kids, and no place to stay. She had one friend who helped her out. So that's one reason why the mitigation evidence that was available, it just, the state could show that the mitigating factors that he showed weren't outweighed by aggravating circumstances outweighed the mitigating factors, because he had support of his family. Yes, he was distressed, but he had the support of his family. He went to church. Did he take, you know, he was a church-going man. Did he take the comfort and wisdom offered from his cousin or the people he saw at church? No, he said, I'm going to kill him. You know, he said weeks before he killed her, he said, if you leave me, I will kill you. And he said that in front of, he said it more than once, and he said it in front of their daughter. She was 12 years old. And when he convinced himself that his wife was unfaithful, and there's absolutely no evidence that she was, when he convinced himself that she was unfaithful and that she had been seeing another Sunday school teacher, he started saying, I'll kill him too, and then I'll kill myself. He said, I will kill him too. And the night before he committed that murder, he told his cousin, who was a deacon at the church, I want to kill him. I want to kill him. He spent that week looking for her. He went from place to place, church to church, looking for her. She spent that week going from motel to motel and hiding her car so he wouldn't find her. She ended up at that house on Pepper Drive in Huber Heights because she had a friend, Donnie Sweeney's mother, who helped her go to the hotels, helped her find this house, and helped her move in. The house was empty because they didn't want to leave a paper trail where he could find her. She used her maiden name when she went and got the utilities because she didn't want him to find her. Donnie Sweeney was at that house that day because his mother, who taught Sunday school with him and with Rhonda, had sent him over with a box full of odds and ends for the kitchen because that house had basically nothing in it except what Brenda bought for her and a grill. That's why he was there. Dwayne Short was there because he couldn't stand the idea that his wife would leave him. And he went to that house because he couldn't stand the idea that he couldn't control his wife. And when he found Donnie Sweeney in the backyard, he shot him. Shot him in the chest. Donnie said, no, man, don't, and he shot him. And then he went into the house his wife got when she left to be safe from him. He brushed past his kids, kicks in the bathroom door, and shoots her point blank in the chest.
Well, none of those facts are in dispute, though, are they?
No, but they explain why the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors and why I'm asking this court to find that death is appropriate and it's proportional.
So this case really boils down to whether or not counsel were ineffective in waiving mitigation and not presenting a psychological examination. Is that the
counsel,
essence of it?
Well, counsel didn't waive mitigation. Dwayne Short himself waived additional mitigation.
And the court complied with Ashworth and the other requirements in your view?
Oh, absolutely. The court had two competency evaluations, and there was no suggestion at all on the record that this person was ever anything but utterly competent. So this decision not to put additional mitigation evidence on, not only was it a sound strategy on this record,
it was the request of the defendant,
it was
the same request he had when he entered his plea. He didn't want mitigation, and then he decided to withdraw that and go to trial, and he still didn't want mitigation.
Correct.
So and his really did want to get the facts out in public as to what had occurred.
Which he did also in his allocution, which was more settling scores than find some good in me. His attorneys did a good job with the information in the record and made a plausible, powerful argument that, unfortunately for him, wasn't the facts contradicted.
Thank you.
So for these reasons, unless there's any other questions, I'm asking once again for the court in its dependent evaluation to find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors, to find that death is proportional, and to impose a sentence of death.
Well, the aggravating circumstances are multiple killing?
Multiple killings with respect to both victims and with respect to Rhonda.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. And with respect to Rhonda, it is felony murder based on the aggravated burglary when he went into her home.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Krim, you've saved 5.5 minutes.
Mr. Krim, if I could start off with a question. The one thing that troubles me about this case is if, in fact, as it appears in the record, that this was the strategy of Mr. Short's counsel, to accept your argument would be to open every time a defense attorney decides that they waive mitigation. And Mr. Short is clear in his remarks to the judge that I want to waive mitigation, and after talking to my attorney, that was his strategy anyway. You open the court up to floodgates, and I'm not sure what is the rule of law you actually want us to apply in this case.
Well, the rule of law would be Strickland, and this floodgate is open in every case. It usually is opened in a post-conviction proceeding.
But it rewards trial counsel for deciding that they're not going to put on any mitigation so that they can get yet a second bite at the apple, either before the judge or in post-conviction.
That's why very rarely do you see lawyers, Rule 20 certified lawyers, waiving mitigation in such a way. You see them arguing against waiving mitigation when some defendants want to. The problem is that you have, it's one thing to say what a nice guy he is and how good he is, and you should forget the 7 hours or whatever they argued in their case. But this is a more complex situation, and you need to explain why someone like Mr. Short would do what he did. And to do that, you need the kind of psychological and information that I suspect is in the post-conviction petition. It is my contention that when they announced ahead of time that they had, that they hadn't talked to the family, but they were going to already decide no psychologist, no investigation, no mitigation investigator, because in Ohio, it is usual the race to get to the public defender's office, so you get one of their investigators to do a mitigation investigation in these kinds of cases.
So you're saying the standard should be that in every capital case there must be a mitigation expert appointed?
I believe in every case the lawyers have an obligation to investigate mitigation thoroughly. And frankly, the most efficient way to do that is with a mitigation investigator.
So the fact that they represented to the court that they had thoroughly investigated and they determined they did not need a mitigation expert should not be considered.
I believe that one of the factors I think the court should have taken into consideration is that they were not Rule 20 certified. I'm not sure that they understood what they saw mitigation as you look at the record, is pointing out what a nice guy our client is. And that is not an adequate explanation for jurors in a situation like this. And I think that's why you have the kind of explanation. I think if you compare the comments that the closing argument on mitigation with the argument that was just made on, basically on whether or not Mr. Short should be executed, you'll find that it was a very different argument, that it was not a well thought out or a well planned kind of argument. It was basically a very quick narrative. I would also ask the court to look at pages 2570, 2571, and 2572, which happened during the allocution, but he's discussing what he did with his lawyers. I don't believe that Mr. Short was in charge of his case. I believe that he was doing basically what the lawyers told him to do. And when he talks about their strategy, he doesn't talk about, he says there was a strategy. He doesn't, there's no explanation what that was.
Counsel, your time's running out quickly. Back to Roe, and you suggest we ought to revisit Roe. Do you know if the federal courts have weighed in at all on this? The statute seems to be clear that all mitigation evidence is to be presented to the jury. You're suggesting the other statute should be in play as well. And that's not what the court found. They found this to be an exclusive process,
But what is happening, as we have in this case, is judges are using additional information.
All right. You've got a minute left. You want to make an argument for this gentleman's life? Ms. Ingram did a pretty nice close. It was like we're the jury here.
We have addressed these issues in the brief. I don't believe, if you look at Mr. Short's allocution, I don't believe that it is simply blaming other people. I think it is not a, I don't think he had a lot of assistance in forming that, but I believe that he was explaining his view of what happened. And I don't think he is denying responsibility. I would point out that under Propositional Law 14, we do address the issues that were addressed by counsel. I'm frankly not used to making closing arguments before appellate courts.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.